Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk about my work. And so just let's see. Oops. Yeah, so in like my presentation outline will just simply be I'll give a very, very brief overview of the Lambda CDM cold dark matter paradigm, as well as self-interacting dark matter and a bit on gravel thermal evolution. And I've done a lot of different kinds of research. I've used strong lensing. I've done like modeling with Markov chain Monte Carlo methods and things like that. But with limited time, I decided to focus on my biggest projects, which are gravel thermal evolution in both the long mean free path and the short mean free path regime. But I'm really excited to talk to you about the short mean free path regime part. And then I'll end with some concluding remarks. So normally I'd expand a lot more on this, but we all know that that CDM is extremely successful, and so on large scales, it produces like we could see cosmic webs of dark matter, for example, in simulations. But what's magical is that we actually see the same thing in observations. Now, we find problems when we zoom in on smaller scales. So when we look at like things like dwarf galaxies and their cores. I'll just kind of lump in a couple of the problems that we see. So the core cusp problem and the diversity problem. Where the core cusp problem is that with cold dark matter, so simulations will predict very dense cuspy cores, whereas what our observations tell us is that we actually find that that dwarf galaxies are a lot more cored than they are cuspy. Another issue is the diversity problem. So in some spot, these are spiral galaxies that you see on the right here. And so this kind of is like the prediction with some band scatter. And then these are the data points. And what you can see is that although for example, these two galaxies are they have the same Vmax, meaning that they're kind of like the same mass. And in an NFW profile, which is typically used for example, CDM profiles, we have two parameters that are actually correlated. And so it is almost reduced to one parameter with some scatter, meaning that if I have a galaxy that is, or two galaxies that are the same mass, then their rotation curves should look the same. But we don't find that. We find that they actually look quite different.
I was going to ask
So,
about that actually. Sorry. So you're saying that for galaxies with similar mass, the rotation curve should be the same. Is that obvious? I mean, like, so galaxies can have very different morphologies, right? So some of them can be diffuse LSV spirals, and some can be very dense early type galaxies, at the same mass even that can happen, right? And so then why should I expect them to have very similar rotation curves?
right. So, but that's kind of like I guess if we're looking at CDM, that would be the expectation if we're looking at just dark matter. Baryons also, of course, introduce extra things into the mix. But like with CDM, it's a two parameter profile where the two parameters are correlated to each other, and so we should then expect that galaxies of the same mass would have very similar rotation curves. But exactly. They don't.
Okay, so you're saying that these galaxies that you're plotting, these are all totally dark matter dominated?
They're low surface brightness, so yes. Well, they're kind of dark matter dominated, so low surface brightness galaxies.
Okay, so even this upper left one, in the green, you're saying that it's dark matter dominated. The baryons are very unimportant.
I think all of these are actually low surface brightness galaxies, and so I'm gonna say that they have more dark matter than is typical. And that being said, yeah, baryons would modify the profiles. That's true a little bit, yeah.
Okay. All right, cool. Thanks.
And so one solution is SIDM. So a little overview of that is the nice part about SIDM is that it modifies the inner regions of halos. And so all the large scale success, excuse me, all the large scale successes of Lambda CDM are then preserved. They're not, you know, it doesn't tamper with that at all. And so when you introduce sort of scale self-scattering between dark matter particles, you get thermalization that happens. And this leads to an initial stage of core growth where the core grows in size and decreases in density, which creates the core profiles that would explain, for example, some dwarf galaxies that we see. But eventually that actually leads to core collapse where that core will shrink and the densities start to shoot up incredibly fast. Now, initially it was proposed with constant cross sections by Spergel and Steinhardt for specifically the core cusp problem. But in recent more recent times we've noticed that velocity dependent models are probably more likely the ones to use because of observations, because we have a wide range of observations that need to be explained, as I'll show in the coming slides. And this is actually natural in light mediator models. So now the diversity problem is not a problem when we use SIDM. This is kind of like a really busy plot, but I'm just going to ask you to focus on the red curve and the blue dotted curve in these. So this is the, you know, the red curve, and then the blue dotted curve is going to be, yeah, this guy here. So yeah, the blue dotted curve. The blue dotted curve is CDM. It's a CDM profile, and then the red curve is the total SIDM profile, including baryons. And that's the nice thing about the SIDM profile, is that it actually takes the baryon potential into account. And so it provides a better fit for these galaxies that are these similar low surface brightness galaxies as the ones that I had showed previously. But now we also want to, I'm sorry, did I hear a question? Or okay. We also want to preserve, again, you know, we want to preserve what we see on all scales. And so cluster scales typically require that the cross sections are about 0.1 centimeters squared per gram. And in recent work that I did as well, oh, this is not too recent. It's actually one of my first big projects. We placed sort of new constraints on groups, galaxy groups. And so where this kind of region is just the region that would solve the core cusp problem. And we fitted it with a dark photon model with dark matter mass of 15 GeV and the mediator mass with 11 MeV. We just kind of picked it and find that a velocity dependence is preferred as well. Now, further, we're actually finding that in dwarf galaxies, there may be evidence of core collapse. So in this figure here, we see this, these points are actually ultra-faint dwarf spheroidals. And what you're seeing plotted here is their velocity at the half-light radius and the radial point at the half-light radius as well. Whereas these curves are all from simulations that were run by a colleague of mine. These are 1 centimeter squared per gram, and these are 5 centimeters squared per gram. So in both cases, we find that these a lot of these data points actually overshoot the simulations, which suggests that we actually need larger cross sections, maybe greater than 50 centimeters squared per gram, which would indicate that core collapse is occurring. So that motivates this requirement for a velocity dependent cross section. Now, let's talk a little bit about gravel thermal evolution. It's based on a set of fluid equations. So there are a set of like coupled PDEs, partial differential equations, with, you know, mass continuity, hydrostatic equilibrium, thermal conduction, and the first law of thermodynamics is what governs the way that the halo is, that the SIDM halo is sort of balanced. So you have mass conservation and the pressure and gravity are balanced with hydrostatic equilibrium, and then thermal conduction is essentially governing how heat flux moves throughout the halo. And then the first law relates the gradient of the heat flux to the entropy, where the entropy term is right here. Now, gravel thermal evolution is something that occurs in SIDM halos. It's essentially what you have is initially you'll have heat transport that goes from the warm outer halo, NFW halo. Like, if we're assuming that we begin with, say, like an NFW halo, NFW halos begin with like warmer outer regions and cooler cores. And so you have heat transport that flows inward towards the core, and that leads to a decrease in the density and core growth. Eventually, you find that heat begins to be transported from the now hot inner core toward the cooler outer halo. And this actually leads to core collapse. It leads to the core to shrink. And it leads to runaway collapse. It's been dubbed as like the gravel thermal catastrophe by Lyndon Bell and Wood, who actually applied this to globular clusters. And during core collapse, this may lead to black hole formation, which is something that I'm extremely interested in. Now, I want to just explain a little bit about like what long mean free path evolution and short mean free path evolution is. So in long mean free path evolutions, you have like the particles are sparse enough that they're able to make many orbits without scattering with another dark matter particle. During this time, initially your central density decreases, but then it begins to grow. And so you can see here that like these profiles are set for some time t tilde. We set this t tilde equals zero. This is actually the point where the core has become a maximum. And so from that point on, you're gonna have the core kind of shrinking and the density increasing. And so that's kind of where t equals zero comes from, and then so on and so forth. These are just a few profiles that are plotted in the evolution. And another thing I want to point out in all of the figures that I show, where you see sort of dashed lines, you can barely see it on this region here. The dashed part actually indicates short mean free path evolution, whereas the solid is long mean free path evolution. Now, in the long mean, or I'm just going to refer to it as the LMFP. In the LMFP, there are well-known self-similar solutions and universal solutions. So the profiles, once they're scaled appropriately, they essentially look the same no matter what time we're looking at, so long as we're in the long mean free path regime. And universal solutions, which allow us to essentially characterize the entire evolution of the halo. And the bulk, a huge chunk of the evolution of gravel thermal evolution actually occurs in the LMFP. Once we reach the short mean free path or SMFP evolution.
I have a question. Actually, what is the time scale? So on the previous plot, you have these like timestamps in units of what?
Yeah, so this is actually it's I'll show you the time scale later, but it's essentially the scattering time scale. It's normalized by the scattering time scale, but it's first the time while we subtract the time at core formation so that we could set that to t equals zero, normalized by the scattering time scale.
I see. Thank you.
Now, in the short mean free path evolution, here you'll see that I've labeled the I guess the profiles as stages, and I'll talk about the stages a little bit more in the coming slides. But this is essentially just, stage zero is an early part of the evolution, and then so on and so forth. And then stage three is a very extremely late part in the evolution. So once you're in the short mean free path regime, you can see like these two profiles are kind of like reaching that region. And as again, the dashed lines tell you that that part of the halo is in the short mean free path regime. Things are so dense that particles will collide with other dark matter particles many times per orbit. And in this region, you have an extreme increase in the central density as well as temperature. You could see that, like, this is the dispersion. So this is the one-dimensional dispersion normalized by Vmax. And that's related to the temperature. So you can see that the temperature profiles are essentially increasing in the center now. And you can also see that in the density profiles. And this is the region where black formation would occur. Now, I'm just going to show you like a more extreme version. So this is a version with a larger cross section. You can see that the one of the, I guess, the latest profile is like really extreme. Almost the core almost separates off from the outer profile. And yeah, and then a giant region of it is in the short mean free path regime. So just now with that background, I'm going to talk about my first, I guess it's a companion project. So it's the initial project where we started with the long mean free path evolution.
Can I ask you also here? So yeah, how do you know that the black hole forms rather than, yeah, another option is that this whole kind of quark kind of bounces back, right? And you have an explosion, something like this. Like,
yeah. It's a good question. We think that it would, that a black hole would form, but yeah, we don't know for sure. And simulations aren't able to actually go far enough to see that. So it's a good point.
So we don't know at this point, right? I mean, what happens?
Really? Correct. Yeah. We don't know for sure, but like once you're in the short mean free path regime, it's hard to imagine this bounce back. So like that bounce back that you're talking about is something that happens in globular clusters.
Yeah.
But globular clusters only, they have, well, they only interact gravitationally for one. And also they have these sort of binary interactions that prevent the core from collapsing. Whereas dark matter is not going to, or self-interacting dark matter specifically is not going to is not going to experience that. So we think that it would actually just collapse into a black hole. There's no reason
for it
to really.
It has a sort
back.
Of pressure, right? So because of this, I mean, yeah, it does have pressure. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering if kind of you can have a shock wave that just will blast everything out, you know?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, there is pressure due to the interactions. But yeah, I don't know. I don't really know the answer to that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
So now I'm going to show essentially what how we kind of normalize the t and set it to t equals zero. So this point here, this is a plot of the central density with respect to the dispersion, the central dispersion, both normalized by rho s and Vmax. And so once we reach what we call core formation or maximal core, where the size of the core reaches a maximum and it turns over and then it starts to shrink, that's where we kind of set it to t equals zero, and that's that point. And these are parameters that we get from this core formation region. Oops, yeah, this core formation region that are actually directly related to NFW parameters in this way. And this is going to be extremely useful for us because that allows us to predict almost everything, essentially everything, just knowing these parameters and the cross section model. So the way that we define the LMFP regime is when this relation, these are the conductivity. So this is the short mean free path conductivity ratio to the long mean free path conductivity. When it's greater than one, we're in the long mean free path regime. And in this regime, the conductivity is proportional to this product here, where this Kp is actually just the velocity dependence, the velocity dependent function, which I'll show in coming slides. And this is just kind of like a normalization constant, the cross section. Now we use Gravel Thermal Code, and in the code, what we do is we essentially take the fluid equations that I showed earlier and we make them dimensionless using particular scales. And this is the Kp function I was talking about, where we kind of thermally average over these velocities. And P is something that you kind of, I guess we learned from simulations what it should be, but in our long mean free path paper, we chose, like what you see in the dimensionless cross section here is that we have both conductivities. We used K3, so with P equal to 3 for the long mean free path, and then the K equal to 5 for the short mean free path part of the evolution, which we learned later that actually P equals 5 is more appropriate and it works more with simulations. Here's that now here's the universality. Once this is the scattering time scale, and once we scale that scattering time scale out, as you can see here again, T core is just the time at core formation, so that we can set that to 0, and N is essentially kind of like the strength of the velocity dependence, where 0 is pretty much close to it's essentially a constant cross section, and this is like the strongest velocity dependence. And as you can see here, once we've scaled all this out, the evolution of these halos is pretty universal, with only a small scatter due to the velocity dependence. And so this is a plot of the log of the central density to the central dispersion. And we actually compared to two people's work. So this is Balberg, Shapiro, and Inagaki, who did it for constant cross sections. So these, you know, the self similarity and the universal solutions were well known for constant cross sections, as well as, you know, for this case where the LB, this is Linden, Bell, and Eggleton. We abbreviated that in the paper. Did it for the N equals 4 case, which is where they were doing it for globular clusters. And so you can see that our work actually agrees with them. So these kind of constant regions are where the halo is in the long mean free path self-similar solution. And so we came up with a new time scale where this is almost pretty much exactly almost the same as what the previous time scale was, except for us, we've now introduced this N, which allows us to include a velocity dependence in our self-similar solutions that we can and our universal solutions. So that was the big thing of our work, was that we actually generalized the self-similar solutions and universal solutions to any velocity dependence. And so just in case you wanted to know, like the C1 and C2 are just the separation of variable constants that come out of the PDEs, and they also kind of agree well, except there's a little bit of a sort of, I guess, scatter again. Now, just to remind you, like the dark blue is going to be like the N equals 0, and our light blue line is like the N equals 3.7, and so they kind of agree relatively well. One of the big things, and it's very important because it's going to become important in the short mean free path work, is that we were able to relate what I'm calling the LS transition is the long mean free path, or the LMFP, to the SMFP transition. So that point where we transition from the LMFP into the SMFP, relating that to core formation. So this VCLS is essentially the parameter at the LS transition, and subscript C0 is at core formation. And so all these relations that we found are essentially generalized this, and we are able to now determine the LS transition points, or the core properties at the LS transition, simply by knowing the NFW parameters. And so now I'm going to talk about the short mean free path regime, where we found a new universality. So now, similarly to the figure that I showed earlier in the long mean free path regime, this is the central density with respect to the central dispersion, and normalized at different with different parameters. So these parameters you can see are subscripted as C10. That 10 is this gamma equals 10 region where the slope of the log of the central density to the log of the central dispersion approaches this value gamma, which is actually equal to 10. And I'll show that in an upcoming figure. So we defined the SMFP regime to be now where the conductivity ratio is less than one. And in the SMFP, the conductivity actually is proportional to the inverse of this product. And then we have a new time scale as well, which looks like this. Now, the gravel thermal methods here that we used are very similar to what we did in the LMFP. We used the same code, but there are some differences. And one of the things that we decided to do in this work was, instead of using the sort of Rutherford scattering cross-section, we used molar-like scattering cross-section so that we can look at the indistinguishable particles, particle interactions, and as well as an increase in resolution, since I'm looking, like, you know, I was looking at the inner regions of the halo, so I was really interested in the core, and so I increased the resolution to be able to probe radii at smaller radii. And so given that we have done the molar scattering, we chose to use a viscosity cross section. So two common cross sections used in simulations are the transfer cross section and the viscosities cross section. So the transfer cross section regulates forward scattering, but it actually enhances backward scattering, whereas and it doesn't account for example, like in molar scattering, where you have indistinguishable particles, you actually have contributions for the S and the T dot the T and the U channel, not the S channel, the T and the U channel diagrams. And whereas in the case of, like, say, Rutherford scattering, only the T-channel is dominant. And so the transfer cross-section can't really account for the interference that you get from the T and the U-channel contributions, whereas the viscosity cross-section does. And that's why we used the viscosity cross-section in this work. Now, I'm going to try to speed through this. This is where I'm going to talk about the stages of evolution. So in this work, I actually delineated the stages of evolution in a halo. So, this is again the log derivative of the central density to central velocity, and these are just the kind of models that we used with the n. Where now these are velocity dependent cross sections. So I should point out that this is actually n at core formation. So that's what the end is at core formation. And so, okay, so starting with stage zero, I kind of shaded out the regions that are not applicable to that. So stage zero is where we have the core expansion phase. And this is essentially the part that is used to resolve the core cusp problem. In this region, we'll see that the density decreases and we get the more chord profiles, and it ends at core formation, where core formation is maximal core, or when the radius of the core reaches a maximum. And then it turns over to stage one, which is the core contraction phase. Now, in this region, you see the density starts to shoot up, and the radius of the core will decrease, and this is the point where we have, like, the onset of the long mean free path evolution, where the self similarity exists, as well as the LMFP universality. So you can see there these two regions, because or these two sets of curves kind of have a different sort of size, if you will, to stage one, and that's it's because of the larger cross section. So orange is a larger cross section, and with a larger cross section, you spend less time in the long mean free path regime, and so That's why it's actually a little bit shorter. But those are, this is essentially the long mean free path regime evolution. So this is where the, where we have core contraction occurring. Stage two was adequately named by my co-author, called the unorganizable phase, because it's essentially something we just really there's nothing to be able to explain it. And it's a departure from the self-similarity and the universality. And you can see that this is where sort of the curves drop off and dip into the short mean free path. So these are already in the short mean free path regime, and they've fallen off the self-similar solution. But magically, what happens is that despite all that, all the curves end up kind of tending to this slope of gamma equals 10. And so this is like a, what we call the constant thermal energy phase. And this is where we found a new, the new SMFP universality, which we were able to actually relate the LS transition parameters, which I mentioned earlier, to the stage three parameters, giving us a semi-analytic method of essentially describing the evolution of halos deep in the short mean free path regime. And just to mention, these diamonds are actually just where we, because it's not, these are the points where we kind of subscript C10. So this is the point where we just call it, we call it the kind of, I guess, the part where the halos reach this gamma equals 10 phase, because these are essentially the minima of the curves. And so we know that after that minima, they're all going to kind of asymptote towards this slope of gamma equals 10. Now, relating these LS parameters to stage three, the way that we did that was we took our points and we kind of plotted the ratio of the parameters at the gamma equals 10 regime, so VC10, as a ratio to VCLS, so the LS parameters. And we plotted it with respect to this N at the LS transition. And we did the same with the density as well. And we found that they follow this pretty close function here, pretty closely that they follow this function, which allowed us to then be able to essentially characterize this, this, which is non-analytic, as I said. So these are non-analytic, but with this form, we actually make it, we kind of make it semi-analytic by relating it to the parameters at the LS transition. And here's another figure where we also showing the relation between actually now the ratio of the central densities to the ratio of the central dispersions, also following this really nice relation here. And then we can now relate this N at the LS transition to the N at the gamma equals 10 transition by doing this. And we kind of just use this form here where we say that this ratio is going to be equal to this ratio, because this function of n, we have a function of n that gives us back the velocity. And so by using that, we were able to get a function for this as well. Now, this is the magical part. We also find that the core or the core region of the core mass is related to the central dispersion in this way. So it's kind of proportional. It evolves as the dispersion to the minus two. And when normalized with the new gamma equals 10 parameters, or I'm going to call them stage three parameters. So when normalized by the stage three parameters, you find that the part of the evolution that is in the short mean free path kind of follows this line here, with some scatter, but it follows generally this line, which would allow us to extrapolate to the relativistic instability, where where we think that actually at the relativistic instability, at that point is where a black hole may form. And so I developed a semi-analytic recipe for obtaining core mass limits. Now, these are bands that are plotted for just a range of M200 from 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 11. It was just kind of, I guess, the range that we were interested in for halos. And using the mass concentration relation, so this is kind of like a scatter of 0.3 decks in the concentration. And so in this figure here, this is the core mass, the relativistic instability, RI. And we normalized it with M200 because it was just a lot easier to see. The bands were really thin if we didn't do that. So we thought that this would be a great way to normalize it. And here we see the core mass at the LS transition, the bands for that. And now I'm just going to mention here that W equals one. This corresponds to a high velocity dependence. So N equals like 3.7, and W equals 10 to the 4, where very large W just means that we're talking like a constant cross section. And these are the relations that we have. So this actually came from our long mean free path paper, which now with our new methods, our new relations that I found in using these previous kind of relations, we're able to come up with a form that gives us the core mass at the relativistic instability. And in fact, it can actually give us the core mass at any point in the short, as long as we're in the state in stage three of the evolution at any velocity. And so this here corresponds to like the upper bound of the core mass that could go into the black hole, and this is like the lower bound. And so the reason why this matters is because we actually think that the black hole would form well before the relativistic instability kicks in. And so it would kind of be a range in between these where the mass that you get. And this is essentially the important or the key one because even in like the it will form we think it will form in the stage three of the evolution. So this would be the form that we use regardless, where we would just instead of the relativistic instability, you could just plug in some other velocity instead, or central velocity.
Hey Sophia, I have a basic actually question. Sorry. I'm trying to understand so for the regime, you know, where the velocity dependence is very steep, right? You know, which I think is this like low W regime, right? Right. So, okay. Well, right. So, you know, so in that regime, do you still get this very strong core collapse where the velocity dispersion rises quickly? And you do, you're saying.
So
I would just think that, you know, so like in that regime, you know, so as the core collapse progresses and the velocity rises, then the cross section starts plummeting. And then yep. I would think then that this process would then saturate. But you're talking though about this like relativistic instability, which suggests that the core collapse just continues all the way until you reach like relativistic velocities. And I'm just puzzled physically, like why that happens.
Yeah. So the answer to that is actually, we don't really know because we haven't been able to actually go into the relativistic instability. So we don't know what actually happens to the halos at those kinds of velocities. And that's a great question. So this is, it's entirely extrapolated. The one thing that I will say, and this is something that we are working on, is that cooling is something that we expect to become important. And once cooling starts, the collapse actually occurs rapidly. And so we think that once cooling starts, that this would actually cause the core to collapse into a black hole, and that we don't even need to go to the relativistic instability.
And so by
this is work that we're working on right now.
Uh-huh. Okay. So does cooling mean like evaporation or something?
Like energy loss and scattering, essentially.
Okay, right. But the scattering process itself is elastic, I guess, right? And so
yes. And so in
oh yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, yeah, I just wanted to, yeah, that this is all with this is all elastic scattering.
So okay, that's true. Right. And so then to cool like the core, you're saying that you know some particles like evaporate off from the core carrying lots of energy, like that's the idea behind cooling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things that I guess we did, which I can show, it's kind of like a backup slide. So this is just a kind of like our extrapolation of where these are the cooling rates. The solid lines are actually how far our halos got. Whereas, so this is the cooling, and then the dotted lines are extrapolated. Whereas up here, this is the heating rate, and a little bit difficult to see, but the dashed lines are where our actual simulations, or excuse me, well, yeah, our halos got, and the dashed dotted lines are the extrapolation. And so the important thing is that the cooling would actually become important well before the relativistic instability hits. And so because the cooling becomes important at that time anyway, we think that we might be able to like approximate it in a way that cooling begins at this point, kind of thing.
Okay, all right, interesting. All right, thanks so much.
Yeah. And so want to do a little bit more. We got to make some more progress on that work, but essentially we think that once the cooling kicks in, not too far after that, the collapse would happen. And so we can actually use this relation and just take that point in the central dispersion and plug it in here and get the mass of the core, which would then go into the black hole. Now, here are the collapse times for these models, where again, so the model is essentially it's 100 centimeters squared per gram at a velocity of 10 kilometers per second, and this is. This swath over here is the highly velocity dependent swath, and then this one is the constant cross section. Everything in the shaded region is something that doesn't collapse within the age of the universe, and so it doesn't matter. But the part that is of interest, because one of the problems that we want to solve is how do we find supermassive black holes so early in the universe's history? And so the region that would be able to explain this is actually somewhere around here. And so the mass of such halos would be kind of like somewhere between 10 to the 8 and 10 to the 9. And that would give us collapse times where this kind of goes down to about 3 gigayears. Three gigayears, and it goes up to one. Yes, a point three gigayears. So that's 300 million years. And that actually goes pretty much far enough to be able to explain how supermassive black holes are formed so early in the universe. So if we could produce seeds at that time that are massive enough, then we're good. And question. So that's the region that we would be interested in.
Question?
Yeah.
What fraction of like, do you get the right abundance of black holes at that time, or just the right masses in this model?
So we actually don't know either. We don't know the answer to that. And one of the projects that I actually want to do is to simulate this. Typically what's done in simulations now for seeding supermassive black holes is that gas is used, but I would do a make a modification where the dark matter would be used instead, and then see how that, you know, how that affects things like the quasar luminosity function and stuff like that, because self-interactions do affect the abundance of black holes. And so that's something that I would want to see. I haven't been able to look into that just yet.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I also have a question here. So actually, actually a very basic one. So the results of the simulation that you showed and kind of the analytic estimates, that were for spherical symmetry, or you go in simulations, you go beyond spherical symmetry?
Spherical symmetry, you're right. Yeah, these are all spherical NFW halos. They begin as spherical NFW halos with elastic scattering. And they're okay. Isolated also.
Right, but then I think that kind of the main problem to kind of create like supermassive black holes from dark matter is to shed the angular momentum. So I wonder if this is captured actually by your approach or not. I mean, kind of, what's the mechanism of shedding the angular momentum in your case?
It's a good question. So we haven't really looked into that. Yeah.
Okay. So that would require, I believe, like 3D, right? To go to 3D simulations or things like, or at least 2D. Right?
Yes. Cosmological simulations. So the thing with simulations is that with SIDM simulations that try to reach core collapse, the simulations just aren't able to go further than that. So we never actually reach the point where big core collapse actually happens. And so my proposal is to, like, what I want to do is essentially skip all that. So, and then just kind of plunk in black holes of a specific mass, depending on dark matter and depending on the halo mm-hmm. parameters.
Right. No, yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, that kind of having this self-similar behavior, I just wonder if it's kind of stable with respect to non-spherical perturbation, right? If all this will be still valid or not.
Yeah, it's a good question. Mm-hmm. Things, yeah, those are things that we haven't included. We just did spherical. So that's, yeah, it's a good question. I just haven't, I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, it's this is a semi-analytic method that essentially just given only your initial halo parameters, so like the NFW parameters, or which are also related to the mass and concentration, so just mass and concentration equivalently, as well as your particle physics model, so like what kind of velocity dependence you have and an input of a cross section will tell us what our bounds on the black hole mass will be. Just like that. And that's great because we get to skip using these gravel thermal solvers. Things to note is that these are isolated halos and they're actually spherical as well, as we just discussed. And whereas in simulations, you will have things like you'll have subhalos, for example, and subhalos will have gravitational interactions, and which tends to cause them to have what we like truncated NFW profiles. But the nice thing is that truncated NFW profiles tend to accelerate core collapse. So that's great. We do use the Born approximation here to simplify things. And so it's only valid where the Born approximation is valid. So essentially the coupling constant of the dark matter and the dark matter mass is much smaller than the mass of the mediator. And these are dark matter only. Including baryons is something that we'd have to do, because in the simulations is what I'd want to include baryons, as well as cooling. These are both things that will also accelerate the collapse. So currently what we're doing is looking into the cooling part, as I discussed earlier, to be able to incorporate that and see if we can make some other approximations. So again, it's semi-analytic, so there's a lot of assumptions and approximations involved, but it's fantastic because running the gravel thermal equations, or excuse me, running the gravel thermal code is very long, and so you get to skip all that. And so to sort of summarize what the sort of key points that I want you to take away from this is that SIDM is a viable dark matter model in place of CDM, for example, where you don't, you know, you maintain all the successes of CDM at large scales, while also resolving the small scale issues. Now, we have been able to now characterize the LMFP evolution of SIDM halos with a self-similar solution and universal solution that includes a velocity dependence. This is something that was done for the first time with us. Prior to that, it was only for constant cross sections. And now in the SMFP evolution, I found a new universality that allowed me to make these semi-analytic predictions of the parameters that are of the core parameters in stage three, where stage three is actually where the black hole would form. So we don't need to use the gravel thermal code here. And it provides better black hole mass estimates because we've now found these relations and that follow in the stage three of the evolution. Thank you. Now I will open up to questions.
Thanks very much, Sophia. For a very interesting talk. I know there were several questions during the talk, but does anybody have other questions now? Matt?
Hey, Sophia, good to see you.
good to see you too, OG. Yeah, great, wow.
So I was wondering how or if N-body simulations of SIDM have any been done that include velocity dependent cross sections, and if so, do they have the dynamical range to explore sort of what happens beyond the symmetry assumptions that you've made?
So yes, there are simulations that include the velocity dependent interactions. I'm looking at Gizmo. Gizmo is a simulation code that does that. It also includes hydrodynamics, so you can include both. No simulations are able to go beyond this point. Like once the halos start to collapse, that's it. It just can't do it. So we don't know how to simulate that part yet.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions? I was curious if you've looked at all at these this idea of these prompt cusps, these sort of very early, very small collapsed halos, and how the structure of those would be affected in self-interacting dark matter, if at all. I don't know. I haven't thought about it.
Can you maybe just reword the question so I'm sure that I understand what you mean?
Sorry, so there's been a lot of work recently on looking at the sort of very early halo formation from sort of initial density perturbations mm-hmm. called prompt cusps, and you get these sort of small scale little halos that may or may not sort of persist through sort of within other halos or during cosmic evolution. And I'm just wondering if the structure of those would be affected by any of these processes with self-interacting dark matter.
So that's a good question. I haven't thought about it, but I will say that one possibility is that maybe, for example, if you had self-interacting dark matter and you had like a very high cross-section, then you could actually have the halo just zap into the short mean free path regime where your central density just shoots up. I would have to look into it a little bit more just so I could see whether these are actually kinds that could resemble core collapse, for example. If not, then I'm not sure, but my guess would be then that, like, again, we would kind of like start with this NFW assumption, and then they would sort of interactions would create a core and then cause it to collapse. But yeah, I'd have to look into it a little bit more to see if they could be core collapse examples, for example. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Other questions? Okay. If not, let's thank Sophia again for a very nice talk.
Thank you so much for having me.